Chrome-plated shovels were planted in dirt, but it was obvious heavy equipment had been working for weeks.
That was Dan Verbeck, now retired from KCUR, describing the scene at the groundbreaking of the East Patrol Police Station and Crime Lab at 27th and Prospect. That was about a year and a half ago. Mayor Sly James was there touting the new facility.
By having a larger KCPD presence in this neighborhood, I want the residents to see that we're on the same page. We're concerned about safety. We're concerned about having a police presence where we want one and need one. And we're concerned about economic development.
The spanking new complex, complete with a community-driven public arts project, is scheduled to open next year. Good news, right? Well, not for some of the residents who used to live on the site, in houses that were torn down to make way for progress. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking about eminent domain. That is, the right of a government or its agent to take over private property for the greater public good with payment or compensation. So how is eminent domain used in Kansas City? We're going to start that exploration in the Wendell Phillips neighborhood. For that discussion, we've got a couple of guests. First, I'd like to welcome Matt Rahner to the show. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Gina.
Right before the demolition crews showed up and people had to be out of their homes, you took photos of residents in their homes on those blocks where the police complex is currently being built. What inspired you to do that?
Initially, I read an article in the Pitch Weekly by Matt Pierce titled Blight Flight. And as I read this article, you know, I had more questions, I think, than answers from it. So I contacted Amina Powell, who was mentioned.
Well, let's back up for a second.
Yeah.
You read this article. What was in the article? What was it that you read that raised questions for you?
So they pretty much just lined up the city's plan for the neighborhood, and they laid out the plan for the East Patrol Police Station and Crime Lab. And they interviewed a few residents who were kind of distraught about losing their homes. But they kind of ended there, and there wasn't much questioning whether this was the right thing to do or really, they didn't delve into the history of the neighborhood. So, I just kind of always had this interest in eminent domain as like a way for one entity to forcefully and legally relocate others against their will. So, for me, I wanted just to investigate this and see what was the city's intention and how the neighborhood felt about it.
What was going on in your life at the time?
I was a graduate student at the University of Missouri in Columbia.
In what field?
Art, photography.
So your idea was to explore this issue, this political issue and this civic issue mm-hmm. with a camera. What did you think that a camera could tell you?
Well, I think it was a way to build a history that was going to be erased sooner than later. It was a way for me because I knew this neighborhood, a lot of the homes were built in the, 1800s, late 1800s, early 1900s. So they've been standing for over 100 years. And for me to photographically document the homes and the residents could begin to build a history of the place of Kansas City.
Before it's gone. Well, tell me about who you met, what you saw when you first arrived, and then we'll introduce our next guest.
Sure. So I first met Amina because I contacted her.
And she is our next guest.
We'll meet her in a second. Uh-huh. And she introduced me to a lot of residents, her neighbors, and other residents. And I also just walked to the neighborhood, and I would introduce myself to people and talk about eminent domain and take their pictures.
Did you meet anyone who stands out in your memory whose story you'd like to share?
I met quite a few people, actually. The Lyman family, they lived on Olive Street, and they moved in their home in the 50s, and they raised four generations of their family in the home. So great-grandmother, grandmother, mother, and their kids. And they were really attached to their house. I became pretty good friends with them and actually photographed they kind of had a big party before they moved out, before their house was demolished. And I photographed that and got to know them really well. And I visited them at their new home since then. But for them, they were really just connected to the place. And, it was a pretty special place for them.
Amina Powell, former homeowner in Wendell Phillips, good morning and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Were you at the party that Matt just described?
No, I didn't have any. I wish I were, but no, I didn't have any idea that they were having a party. And there were lots of parties similar to that at all of the homes in the neighborhood.
Where was your home, Amina?
I was located at 2611 Brooklyn. So it's a main thoroughfare there and on a hill. And I lived just down the street from my mom. And my mom grew up in that neighborhood. And my dad grew up in that neighborhood. And for us, the neighborhood is special.
Had you grown up in the neighborhood yourself, or had you been in the process of relocating there?
No. I grew up on 27th in Brooklyn, where my mom still lives. And I know all the kids, all the people there, the parents, the grandparents that still own the homes or lived in the homes. Of course, the kids have probably moved on, and some of them still live there. But I grew up in the neighborhood, went to Wendell Phillips Elementary School and did well there. And so that neighborhood is special to us.
What was it like for you both growing up there and then living there as an adult?
That's a big leap,
yeah,
to be honest. When you're a kid, you're just oblivious to kind of all of the nuances that you have to consider as an adult. So it was a big leap. I would say a lot of responsibility that I didn't anticipate, even after being active in real estate and selling real estate. It was a big leap, to be a homeowner. Yeah. To be responsible if the roof leaks or if the gas isn't working or the, you know, whatever goes wrong, you've got to fix it. And that was a lot of responsibility. It was something I embraced, but it was a lot of responsibility.
Is there anything about the neighborhood that I know it's special to you because you grew up there. Is it special to you for other reasons? Are there specific things about it that you think you wouldn't find somewhere else?
Yeah, there's a total connection to community. I mean, you can't get that in suburban communities that are built for the, you know, built in the recent past or 5 years. There's no connection there. But here there was a connection. I had a history there. My family had a history there, or it still does. Even though my house is gone, my family still is very much part of the community. You can't replace relationships and bonds and familiarity with neighborhoods. I mean, there, you know, shortcuts and things to, you know, navigate the city and understand what's going on. And yeah, it's upsetting.
How did you first find out that the city was interested in your home and the surrounding homes?
Well, that's a good question. the way that the city did this, I don't know. I don't think I have anything positive to say about the way the city has implemented this project. It was not equitable. Number one, the city, almost in a kind of like a drug bust manner, they delivered these notices. So they parked a van at the end of the street, and all these people got out as if there was some type of sting or operation police sting or something. And they went to people's houses very aggressively. Some of those people had guns on their hips and things, and they passed those notices out and said, "You show up to this meeting." And it took us, we didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, you had heard nothing about it up until this point?
Nothing about this project. Just one day you come home and there's a notice that says you have to come up to a meeting, and you miss the meeting, or, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but it was very severe process. It was not human. I've never been treated that way. And so I'm still, you know, recovering from all of that.
Matt Rahner, when you showed up to photograph and explore this area, is the story that Amina just told us the story that you heard from lots of people?
Definitely. I think I talked with a lot of residents who were not happy about this, and they were just shocked to find this to happen. Talked to a few residents who had anxiety issues, actually had to be hospitalized. I mean, imagine living in your home and your day-to-day life, and then all of a sudden you have to move. You have to find a new home. And you weren't planning on this. You were planning on staying in your house, retiring in your home. Or, people had been had just redone their whole home, remodeled their home. So it was definitely a shock for a lot of people. People were questioning the validity of it. You know, was this responsible of the city? Was this something that the city really needed to do? And could they have done it in a different way?
If you want to see Matt's photographs, we have a little slideshow of a few of them on our website, kcur.org. And Matt, as an outsider showing up in the final days of this neighborhood, what stood out to you about the community and what it was experiencing? Because a lot of these, the tension itself is something I think we would expect. Mm-hmm. Was there anything you didn't expect?
I think for me, so the people I photographed were the last ones to leave, and a lot of those folks were the ones who were the most connected to the neighborhood itself. So they had the most stories to tell. You know, they knew everybody on their street at one point. They'd grown up there. The Hadley brothers grew up there since they were 3 and 4 years old, and they were in their 60s. So, you know, they knew everybody on the street at one point or another, and they all had connections. And I think for me that was, you know, I didn't know what to expect going in. I think some people left early, but then other people who stuck around, they didn't want to leave. They were, you know, really connected.
They were the holdouts.
Yeah, the holdouts, exactly.
And were a lot of these people older?
Yes, I think the majority were older. 65, 70, and they were all, retirement age.
Had you been inside the houses in this neighborhood before you did this project?
No, I had not, no.
What was it like for you to go inside these houses? Driving down the street, looking at houses in any neighborhood, you kind of get a feel for what life might be like mm-hmm. inside, but that's mostly a product of your imagination.
Sure.
What did you discover when you set foot inside these homes that people were wanting to hold on to?
You know, like the Lyman family, I went in their home and it was beautiful and they had this, you know, wonderful living room and it was, you know, well taken care of. And a lot of these homes were three stories. And yeah, I could get to the third story of a lot of the houses and see downtown Kansas City. And, you know, they're wooded lots and really beautiful. People had gardens and things. So it was, you know, like any other neighborhood I was in. Or house I've been in, you know, it was a home. It wasn't just a house.
A lot of the portraits in your Eminent Domain series were taken on front porches. Is there some significance in that?
The significance of that for me, I mean, there's a few. This is where I met most of the people outside. We talked outside, and then also to get them in front of their house, or you know, on their land, or. Not really a significance. I think the significance comes in as how they positioned their, frontal. They kind of have almost a defensive look to them because I believe my camera acted as a fill-in for the city. I was gauging a reaction of the residents to this, you know, the city and to this process. Because we would have a long conversation about Eminent Domain and how they felt, and then I would ask to take their picture. So I think you get a sense of how they felt.
Their emotions are on their faces in that moment.
In that moment, right.
Amina, growing up in this neighborhood and living in this neighborhood, tell me about the front porches. Are these places people spent a lot of time? Because in these photographs, they look very inhabited, these front porches.
Yeah, the front porch is where is social hour for a lot of people. Number one, we on the hill, we always had a nice cool breeze to come through there. So give us an opportunity to get outside of the house. There was gardening going on. So, and you invite your neighbors over. We sit on the porch for hours and talk about things and talk about the kids and talk about what we're planning to do in the future and all of those things. So, yeah, it was a social social moment.
So Matt, there's a series of two photos that it's kind of a before and after where there's this blue house. You see it from the side. It looks well maintained. The lawn's kept up and everything like that. And then in the next image, the windows are boarded up. What's the story of that house? Who lived there?
So that was Mr. Joe's house. And he lived on Park Avenue. And he was kind of a staple in the neighborhood. Kids would come over and he sold... Mr. Joe sold, you know, snacks and drinks out of his to the neighborhood children. So he was really a part of the neighborhood, and his house was well maintained. New roof, new windows, new siding, and so the two pictures back to back kind of show. One was before when he lived there, and the second one was after he had moved out in the city, boarded up all the windows with these white boards, and it was kind of the whiteboards were kind of a symbol that that people were gone from their homes. There's actually a third picture that I have of that where the house is just completely demolished and it's gone. So, yeah, I tried to do a few before and afters to show the progression of eminent domain.
What is your personal, like, emotional world like when you look at those two photos? Do you see a story of a house or a story of a person?
I think a person, really, because everything down to, like, the color, you know, the color of the siding, the garden, or any sort of anything on the outside, I see a story of a person, you know. I think people get really connected to the place they live, especially if they've lived there more than 10 years, 20 years, you know, 30 years. So I see it as a story of a person.
Is there a small moment, like a personal moment, that you find yourself thinking about a lot when you look back on your time photographing the residence of Wendell Phillips? Just like a personal encounter that you
had?
Yeah,
I think Miss Briggs, Anita Briggs, we became pretty close. And, you know, she's retired and raising her grandchild. And I always would go over there when I went to the neighborhood, and we would talk and just sit in her living room. And we just had a lot of nice encounters. So I think for me, that was like a something I've taken away and a relationship I've kept up.
Amina, what about you? Is there a moment that you can't shake from your head, like a moment that you keep going back to, either from just your time in the neighborhood that really captures it, or from the time when you were being uprooted?
I think what Matt hit on is that, you know, Mr. Burns he's kind of an icon in the community because he had all these kids I went to school with. And so, yeah, there's a lot of connections. Miss Briggs is very special to me. I mean, her property abutted mine in the back at the alley. Mm. So, yeah.
When you think about her, what do you think about?
I think she doesn't look her age at all. She's very youthful for her experience and her position in the community. But and then she's still got it, and she's still doing things and that you wouldn't expect someone of her age to be doing, and raising kids and still trendy and all those things. And so I just hope one day when I'm her age that, you know, I'll have those same characteristics. So yeah, I admire Miss Briggs a lot, and she's a good friend of mine.
Where does she live now?
We moved her to a house near Raytown. So it's a larger house with acreage, and she's doing okay.
Would you say that the house she's in now, is it just, if you were not evaluating any of the things we've talked about before, things like community and connection, is it a nicer house?
It definitely is a nicer house. Yeah, for sure. It's a newer house, so it's not. Miss Briggs had a love of older homes, as did I. I mean, my house was built in 1895, and so, you know, in certain parts of the town, that's a coveted characteristic for a property. But here, for some reason, it is snarled at for some reason. But yeah, her house is built, I think, in the 50s or 60s. So she's got a nice newer house and with some acreage. And it's a quiet neighborhood, not anything like our neighborhood. But I think she'll be fine.
What about you? Where are you now?
We're still fighting the good fight. We still got a legal battle ahead of us. And that's where we are.
Neighborhood wise, where are you living?
You know, I'm a transient right now. So we do what we do.
You know, am I understanding right that the city offered to get 3 different appraisals on each house and to pay the highest amount?
I'm glad you brought that up. It's a narrative that someone ought to peek into. The 3 appraisals, yes, they did get the 3 appraisals. The problem with those appraisals, number one, is that they write into them a pattern of discrimination, a type of redlining, if you will. So none of those appraisals were, for me, legitimate.
And you've mentioned that you're involved in litigation with the city.
Yes.
But we'll acknowledge that, and that we invited the city. They were glad we were having the conversation, didn't feel that they could come in the midst of it. But so anyway, just wanted to put that out there.
It's a public project. I don't know why they'd have any apprehension about talking about a public project that should be on the public record. But Nevertheless, the valuations that the city did, I'll give you for instance, one of the ladies that did appraisals, her name was Gail Beatty. She's state representative. She did the appraisals through HDC Consulting, and she was very politically involved in this project. And I feel like somebody in her position maybe shouldn't have been given the resources to be able to dictate what value was going to be in that neighborhood.
These are all things that we'll have to look up and look into. But do you think, have you met anyone who was really not shedding tears over this move, who was maybe grateful for getting a good resale value on the house, happy to relocate?
Yeah, there were a lot of property owners that were either blindsided by the city's project, bought off, or threatened by the police. And I just feel like those people that willingly left were paid a substantial amount of money, or what they considered to be a substantial amount of money, to go quietly.
Matt, did you, I guess you showed up after the first wave of people had already left. What was the spirit that you encountered? Was it one of sadness and frustration, or happiness to still be there for however much longer?
I think people were still happy to hold on to their homes. I mean, I met a resident, Joe Watson, who was up until the week before he moved out, was still cutting his grass, you know. And I talked with him, and he was very upset. He used to work for the city and actually the planning, some sort of planning commission. And so he rented out the bottom half of his house and lived in the top half. And the city didn't recognize this as a second source of income for him. And, you know, he was upset he wasn't getting a just compensation for that. You know, he kind of relied on that. People, yeah, were just happy to be in their home. And I know people went to church in the area or had friends just south of, or north of 26, you know, that would, you know, they'd always have gatherings and things. So people up until the end were really happy to be in their home.
What did your camera teach you? I mean, you went in there hoping to learn something with your camera. Do you think that there's something that particular tool and combined with this particular moment could teach us about eminent domain?
I think my camera, to a point, was just a way to document the people who live there and the structures and the land. For me, though, in my exhibition, I started to collect objects that I found in the home. So old books, photographs, diaries, things like that. Anything, old negatives, you know, photographic negatives. And the accumulation of these objects, I really felt like with my pictures, sort of to begin to tell the story of a neighborhood. Where my pictures fell short, these objects kind of picked up. And together, they really speak to this place as a place that has a history. So I kind of call it an incomplete archive of the neighborhood.
Do you have a favorite object?
There's a few. A sweater that I found was really interesting, just kind of visually, but also this horse I found, kind of childhood rocking horse I found, is one of my favorites because it kind of relates to a picture on the wall of Marcus Lyman, who's sitting on a lion in front of the Lyman's house. It's like this concrete lion, and he always had done it since he was a child. And so when I found this horse, I really saw this connection between the picture and the object. And Marcus was kind of a sad case because he was he was murdered about 6 months after I took the picture, just north of this neighborhood. And for me, the real reason that I think the city tried to sell this was like, okay, this neighborhood is dangerous and things like that. But, you know, for me, if you look at crime statistics around the old Van Brunt police station, like this doesn't solve crime. Just to put a police station there doesn't solve crime. So that's a lot what I heard from the residents was that, you know, they didn't think it was necessarily going to help things. Like they didn't, a lot of people said, well, they didn't ask me what I thought or what could change the city. More police and one less kind of thriving neighborhood isn't going to help the crime problem.
Amina, as far as your neighborhood goes, the Wendell Phillips neighborhood, what do you think the city, if not building a police complex there, what do you think the city could have done for the neighborhood? Can you imagine some other gesture that would have improved things?
Yeah, they did that. Yeah, there are several things that the city could have done and should have done. Number one, they could have just held public hearings to see what the people actually wanted in this area, what they needed. They just assumed that this police station was going to be the catch-all and end-all to all of the problems, and the logic, it just doesn't match up. But yeah, so 6 months, or about 10 months prior to the city's announcement of this project, the city actually installed curbs and sidewalks in our neighborhood. And that transformed that neighborhood for me. I know coming home as a resident, I'm like, sidewalks and curbs can do this for a neighborhood? What else can we just basically do? So it was about, this neighborhood was starved of city services. I bought the house knowing that it would need work, knowing that it would need those curbs and sidewalks. In fact, I replaced the front staircase to my home. And so what it needed was infrastructure and infill and just a little bit of push from the city to restore it, because it wasn't that far off. And the narrative that the city kind of pushes is that there was this incidence of blight, and not in this particular four-block area. Some of the houses were blighted or boarded, but the city never did any blight studies. So one of the things that they could have done to see if this was a good place for this project was to do a blight study to see what needs to happen, what doesn't need to happen, and where the needs are. The city didn't do any of that.
Amina Powell, former resident of the Wendell Phillips neighborhood and complainant in a suit against the city, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
When we return, we'll hear more from Matt Rahner. We'll also have some development experts joining us to share insights on this story and others like it in Kansas City. Eminent Domain in Kansas City coming up on Central Standard. Don't go away. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today we're talking about eminent domain, or the power of the city to take over private property when a public works project requires the land. The use of eminent domain raises all sorts of sticky questions, including what is the public's best interest and according to whom. We've been hearing about the Wendell Phillips on Kansas City's east side, the Wendell Phillips neighborhood. That area was raised a few years back for a new police facility. Now let's broaden the discussion. Photographer Matt Rahner, welcome back.
Thank you.
Mike Taylor is also here. He's with us from the Unified Government of Wyandotte County. Kansas City, Missouri is in the midst of eminent domain litigation and therefore declined to participate in the discussion. But KCK has dealt with this stuff too, so we'll have a municipal perspective from the other side of the state line. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning.
And last but not least, Steve Vockrott is with us from The Pitch. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Steve, anything you'd care to clarify about the concept of eminent domain?
Well, this, you know, the Wendell Phillips example is a fairly rare example, at least in Kansas City Metro's history, where large swaths of residential were condemned on eminent domain. Typically, where you see eminent domain used in Kansas City is for commercial property, either properties that have been largely abandoned or not used and need to be cleared out to make way for new development. You know, it's already zoned for commercial, so that's more typical, more common. Local governments.
Can you give an example of that, since it's the more typical scenario?
Yeah, so Metro North Malls redevelopment, one of the things standing in the way of that project was Dillard's. They own their own store in that area, and they didn't necessarily want to move right away. And so the Planned Industrial Expansion Authority, which is a development agency that probably most listeners aren't familiar with, but they do have the power of eminent domain, they tried that route and went into the courts to try to get control of that building. So that's more often where you see eminent domain locally.
So anything else we need to understand just about the concept?
Yeah, well, I think local governments tend to be very reticent to use eminent domain, particularly for residential properties. It tends to be an expensive process. It can often be drawn out, and it's often controversial, which local governments want to typically avoid.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is there something people tend to miss in these discussions?
Well, you know, I think one of the concepts that really makes headlines in eminent domain proceedings are the folks who are very upset. And it's understandable. I mean, one of the most powerful things that a government can do to its people is take its property. And, you know, there are laws. And, you know, for example, in Kansas, the government has to give the value of the house, the appraised value of the house, plus another 25%. There are a lot of folks sometimes when eminent domain occurs who are pleased with the deal. And that tends not to make as many headlines. They're pleased to have the opportunity to move out. But on the other hand, there are also a lot of people who get very upset for very understandable reasons.
So, Mike, how does this tend to play out in Kansas City, Kansas? There was a big story involving eminent domain, the Speedway.
Certainly. We've had a few high-profile cases. The Speedway was probably the largest. We ended up 228 parcels were taken, and they were largely kind of rural suburban type houses, sometimes on an acre or 5 acres of land, sitting where the Kansas Speedway is now. And 48 of those parcels were taken by eminent domain, 26 homes and 4 businesses. It was controversial. It was a gut-wrenching decision for the Unified Government Commission at the time, but they viewed that getting that NASCAR facility in Kansas City, Kansas was worth it and would be a larger benefit to the greater good of the community.
Can you take me inside that gut-wrenching decision, the conversations that took place, the things people were weighing and struggling with?
I remember then-Mayor Carol Marinovich talked about how a woman who had lived on that land, that the land had been in their family for 90 years, and she was just torn up about having to leave what had been the family homestead. And even though she got 125% of the value plus relocation costs, it didn't matter because of the sentimental value of that being legacy land, if you will, in her family. But again, they made the hard decisions to do it, and it was very controversial. But I think now, and having followed up with a number of the residents that were moved out, they seem to be very pleased with the development that's happened out there, and the Speedway was the catalyst for all of that.
So spell out for me the argument according to which this heart-wrenching story comes second to some other good.
Well, I think that's what the commission at the time had to weigh was of course, the right to own property is really sacred in this country. And along with that, I think, becomes the right of property responsibility. So if you have a slumlord or somebody that's got property they're not taking care of, that's one argument in the case of blight where eminent domain could possibly be a good use. In this case, it was basically to turn it over to private developers and build this huge racetrack facility. So the commission really, I think, felt badly, and many of them didn't want to take that land. But if the people wouldn't willingly sell, which most of them did, the only way we could get it done was to take the property. And again, I think they had to weigh what's better good for the overall community, and they viewed that building that facility was, because look at everything else it's generated out in that area.
Take me back to when the Speedway was just a flicker of a possibility. How did that possibility even come to the surface, and what did you see in it specifically?
Well, I think NASCAR was looking to expand racetracks around the country. They'd originally looked down around Gardner, Kansas, and Gardner, the residents there, didn't want it. And so there was also a site on the Missouri side, but the fact that 435 and I-70 intersect right out by there, and something like 45,000 cars a day drive through that interchange, was something that appealed to NASCAR, and the city was willing to work with them, and we had the available land out there. So again, I think at the time the commissioners saw the economic benefit that it would bring, tourism to the area, and then of course it sparked development of Village West with Nebraska Furniture Mart, Cabela's, and then it's just continued to grow.
So in those future developments, did eminent domain enter those conversations at all?
It did. For the Speedway, it was about the only way. Once people said, no, we don't want to sell our land, we had to. And as I said, we did. We acquired 228 parcels, but only 48 of them involved eminent domain. So by and large, a lot of residents sold and were glad to move.
But then in the development that you were talking about, that Speedway sparking.
Oh, with Village West, there were only two properties that were taken for the 400 acres that's known as Village West. And those were one was an absentee landowner who wasn't even there, and the other one was vacant. So we didn't have to uproot any homes for the Village West area, but we did for the Speedway.
Steve, what's your perspective on this story? Anything we're missing?
Well, I think the Speedway development, and like a lot of others where eminent domain has been used, touches on the one of the most inherent tensions that it's associated with this process, which is if these homes are condemned and are subject to eminent domain, and then it goes to a private developer, a private company like the Speedway Corporation, a lot of folks get upset at that. They view it as, you know, the government's doing a favor for a private company at our expense. And I'm not making that comment about the Speedway, but that's just that's what's seen as, you know, how eminent domain has evolved over the decades. Originally, the concept of eminent domain was governments shall not take property except for public uses. And public uses, you know, in most people's minds come to things like roads, you know, and in Wyandotte County, I believe the 18th Street Expressway back in the 50s made use of eminent domain. And that was for a clear public purpose, to be able to have a road to get people from one place to the other funded by the public. Over the decades, there has been an argument in local government that the public use in eminent domain can include developments that can broaden the tax base. Local governments often want to have more money, which makes sense because as more people move into community, the more costs are associated with maintaining public assets. And so where you've seen the eminent domain conversation shift over the past few decades, and particularly in the mid-2000s with a Supreme Court decision that was pretty critical, is being able to justify the taking of private property and then have that property then be used by a private company or a private entity of some sort. That's where a lot of the tension is in the eminent domain. The Wendell Phillips case is a little different. A police campus is viewed as a public use. Something like the Speedway or the BMW dealership in Merriam, that was a very controversial case a decade and a half ago, where the city of Merriam used eminent domain on a private property to move a BMW dealership. The argument there, again, was this BMW dealership can raise hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in tax revenues for the city to be able to do more things for the broader community.
So other than this, so the Supreme Court decision that you're talking about in the early 2000s, that's a legal change that happened along with the conversation, so to speak, changing. Anything specific locally in either Kansas or Missouri that's changed in those past few decades?
Well, I think with respect to the Supreme Court decision, it was 2004, 2005 when it was handed down. The lawyers among your listeners would recognize that as the Kelo case, was largely seen as being more permissive for using eminent domain for private uses, even though it's a little bit of a misnomer because that had been happening for decades before that. But that was seen as kind of a landmark property rights case. In Kansas, around 2006, the legislature started to tighten up, made it more difficult for local governments to take property by eminent domain. As a response to that case, there was a lot of concern that eminent domain could be used a lot more. And, you know, part of the, you know, one of the conservative values in Kansas legislature is predominantly conservative is property rights. And that should be held as in very high regard. And so in 2006, they changed some aspects of the law to make it more difficult to use eminent domain. And I would argue in Kansas, you've seen it a little bit less than before.
One case that we used eminent domain that a lot of your listeners may drive by is I-70 and 18th Street Expressway, the Prescott Plaza. There's a Sunfresh Market there and a number of shops. For over a decade, that was an abandoned truck stop that was just sitting there decaying, falling apart. The owner had no interest in doing anything with it, and we used eminent domain to take that property and a hotel that was next door that was kind of a source of a lot of crime. And we took those two properties by eminent domain and used it to clear up what in the middle of the inner city was major blight, and it allowed us to build the first inner city grocery store in 30 years in Kansas City, Kansas. And
but then a grocery store, that would be a private business and not yes. a public works project.
Yes, exactly. And it would have, the action that we took to build Prescott Plaza would not be allowed today under Kansas law. The legislature stepped in and said, you can't do this for economic development purposes unless we as the legislature specifically approve it. Now, since they passed that, no cases have come to the Kansas legislature to see how they would deal with that.
So I guess you've mentioned blight is a term that's come up a lot in this. How does blight enter the discussion? And let's first just get a definition of blight from Steve Vakrat.
Well, that's part of the problem with this discussion is the definition of blight is not terribly clear. And particularly in Missouri, it's very broad and been subject to a lot of different interpretations. So blight broadly is this idea that properties become run down. They become, obsolescence starts to take over. And in the public interest, if the government can't come to an agreement with the property owner to sell, then they could use eminent domain to eliminate blight, replace something that's blighted with something that is new and something that is with the times, so to speak. And so that's generally the definition of blight. Of course, it gets stretched, as we've seen more specifically in Missouri than in Kansas. What does constitute blight?
When you say it's been stretched more specifically in Missouri than in Kansas, can you give an example of that?
Yeah, I can give I could go on for a while on this, but, two examples that come to mind. One was there was a proposed development in the Northland on property that was basically just undeveloped pasture land. And the developer made a case for blight saying things like, there's no access roads to this area. Well, part of the tension with that project was, well, that's the nature of undeveloped prairie land. I mean, that's, of course, there's going to be no roads. And so by saying that's blighted, it's almost like a blight by default kind of thing. And it never really went forward. It got stalled out.
What kind of interests me about the blight entering the discussion is that if the idea is that what needs to happen here is so important that there's this project that needs to come through here, should it really matter what condition what's already there is in? Shouldn't it be about the thing that's coming and its importance?
Well, in the context of eminent domain, you have to consider what's there, getting back to the very high power that a government can have to take property. It should then meet also a high standard to be able to take it over.
So part of what we heard from Amina in her neighborhood was that she and others had really committed themselves to the idea of fixing up properties. And it does seem like one person's blight could be another person's work in progress. How do you make that determination? I mean, blood, sweat, and tears are investment.
Well, and that's the inherent difficulty in using this power that local governments have is, with some of these folks, they've lived there for decades. Their family, the property has been handed down through generations. They're trying to work on their property, but maybe properties around them are suffering. It's a very touchy issue. And, getting back to what I said earlier, that's why it's used fairly rarely in Kansas City.
Central Standard is headed off to one last break. We'll be back with Steve Vakrat, Mike Taylor, and Matt Rahner talking about eminent domain in Kansas City right after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. Eminent domain in Kansas City is the topic of today's discussion on Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Steve Vakrat of The Pitch, Mike Taylor representing the Unified Government of Wyandotte County, and Matt Rahner, whose photography show Eminent Domain at the Kansas City Public Library inspired this discussion. Matt, you could have named your show anything. You could have named it Wendell Phillips or 27th and Prospect. Instead, you called it Eminent Domain. Why?
It's a clear and concise description of the use of eminent domain, in this case, on the neighborhood. I think I chose that because it was powerful, and it was also something that people might have heard about eminent domain, but they really don't know what it is.
Do you see your photographs constituting a call for action?
I think a reflection, a call for action, yeah. Maybe to reinvestigate how maybe Kansas City can approach redevelopment or urban development, you know, for sure.
What do you think, what would that lesson be? What would that different approach be?
The different approach would be, you know, maybe a 10-year plan, a 15-year plan, more engagement with the neighborhoods.
So by that you mean more long-range discussions with people and communities?
Definitely. Ask them what they want. And also all the houses that the city owns that are falling apart and decrepit are in these neighborhoods. And then it's also looked at as that's where the blight is, but it's also that's where the homes that the city actually owns. So maybe do something with those homes and try to reinvest money into that area somehow.
Mike, I know you don't represent Kansas City, Missouri, but from a city perspective, what are some of the challenges that looking in from the outside people might not understand? Would what Matt is suggesting be feasible?
I think it could be. One of the issues that we have, and I know Kansas City, Missouri has the same issue, is abandoned properties or absentee landlords, people who don't take care of their property. And I mentioned earlier, certainly property rights is a sacred thing, but I think along with that comes property responsibility. And we're dealing with some legislation right now in Kansas that we brought to give us some more tools to deal with abandoned properties. Certainly eminent domain might possibly be a way to do that. And what we're talking about in this case is abandoned properties. We can't find the owners. They've walked away from it and they owe taxes. Suddenly there's code violations. It ends up, you know, on the demolitions list. I think eminent domain could be a tool that could help in those kinds of cases. And I doubt that very many people would complain about that because it would be taking a property and potentially doing something with it that is just sitting there decaying the neighborhood.
Yeah, Mike's right. I mean, Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Missouri have extensive tracts of land where, you know, they can't figure out who the owner is or the owner is not responsive. And some of the remedies that they have at hand, I mean, you could fine them for code violations. But if the owner of the property lives elsewhere, you know, does it really matter to them? So, you know, there certainly is an argument to be made that eminent domain can be used to improve communities, not necessarily, you know, it isn't always just this heavy-handed tool. It's been used usefully in many instances. And you could certainly make the argument that, you know, Western Wyandotte County has been improved dramatically by the development of the Speedway. You
could make that argument. Spell it out.
Well, you might be able to argue that the Legends may not be there. You may be able to argue that the soccer park, the soccer stadium for Sporting Kansas City wouldn't be there. That was, you know, the Speedway was the catalyst for helping Wyandotte County emerge from, you know, what was typically seen as almost like a bedroom community in the 80s and before to, you know, more substantial part of the metro area.
In the case of the Wendell Phillips neighborhood in Kansas City, Missouri, do you find arguments about crime reduction in the neighborhood compelling? That was a lot of the stated impulse on the part of the city.
Yeah, and I don't know about that. I mean, I think time will tell whether, you know, crime statistics, you have to look at them over a number of years to really be able to say, and whether that lends, you know, whether there's a cause and effect there with just the police station in isolation. I don't know how clearly you can make that case.
Something that has come up a lot in discussions around this neighborhood is that 27th Street was the northern boundary of racial housing covenants during segregation, and that history with a capital H, you know, could have something to do with some of this stuff. Do you think that some neighborhoods and communities are disproportionately affected by eminent domain and its use?
Yeah, because, you know, eminent domain tends to be used in places where, you know, getting back to the blight thing, where properties start to run into various stages of disrepair. That's more commonly associated with low-income neighborhoods. That's where you see abandoned properties. That's where you tend to see more properties with codes violations, which then opens the door for local governments say this is blighted, we can make it into something different. That's not a statement specifically about Wendell Phillips, that's a statement more broadly.
Any way out of this sort of circular conversation where no one's totally happy?
Not that I'm aware of.
Well, we'll just have to keep plugging away at it until we make some progress on that. That's all the time we have for today's show. Steve Vakrat, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Taylor of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County, your perspective was so helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
And photographer Matt Rahner, thanks so much. Compelling show.
Thank you, Gina.
Matt's photographs are on view in the exhibit Eminent Domain at the Kansas City Public Library. We have a slideshow on our website, kcur.org. Check that out. To listen back to today's show, head to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we'll talk about hiking in Kansas and trivia in Missouri. It's a bi-state show on tomorrow's Central Standard. Join us at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's The Standard. Stick around for Up to Date next.